On this particular Sabbath before Mother's Day, a traditional custom, of course, that varies from country to country, would be good that we think of our mothers, aunts, grandmothers. Been impressed with the tragedy that has beset the present generation in connection with this, and that's the feminization of poverty. Because somehow we have lost track of both the role of men and women. Before the sermon, I'd like to take a moment of time and just point up something that you may or may not be fully aware of. And that is, if you think that women's roles have changed in the last roughly 30 plus years, not 30 to 40, drastically, one should realize, too, that men's roles have changed remarkably. Something went wrong at a certain time, as a result of which there was a reaction. And therefore, many women were reared in homes that had as fathers or some male an example that was quite different from what men may have been at an earlier generation. It would be a mistake to assume that every generation was perfect before the next one that goes astray. I use an illustration that was some 20 years ago that I ordered some photographs from one of the, shall we call it, new perspectives of women on the role of men. I thought these would be useful in terms of illustrating the direction that they thought men should go, that I presumed would indicate something that I might find seriously objectionable on the basis of what was happening in society. When I received the photographs, I was astonished. They were recommending the things that my father did. I said to myself, why would they be recommending things that my father did unless their fathers weren't doing them? And it occurred to me that something did happen, first of all, to the role of men between the last quarter of the last century and the late 1940s and 1950s. And that was that men became more and more detached from the family relationship. And as a result of this detachment, many women grew up with an unfortunate example of what fathers should be like, as a result of which many women thought that they should become equal to men in terms of the job responsibilities that should be theirs. Now, there is a society, of course, or was, one in which women had many of these wonderful jobs. It was called the Soviet Union. In fact, there wasn't anything that men could do that women weren't assigned. And you know, of course, what has happened tragically in Russia and other republics at the breakup of the USSR. But I think it would be important for me just to comment on that fact that we must not assume that the direction in which many women chose to go, but not necessarily a majority, who were spokesmen for a movement, was in part a reaction to the direction in which men had moved in terms of pursuing the corporate ladder, pursuing drink, pursuing television, pursuing pleasure, pursuing cars, vacations, whatever. Pursuing the lack of responsibility toward children by the passing out of money as if money solved the problem of a parental relationship. My father was born 9 years before Herbert Armstrong was born. His father was born in 1845. Now, there are some, I think Mr. Mock's generation, Hugh Mock's generations are even more widely separated. So my father essentially was a mature working person at the end of the last century. When I was ill, He cared for me. He is one who played with me. That's one of the recommended things. He took care of me. I'm not talking about what my mother did, although this is the weekend in which we honor that, but I'm pointing up. It was the abandonment by many men of responsibility and putting all this responsibility on women. The care of the children, the care of the home. Well, part of the reason was I grew up on a farm. Small by comparison to those of the Midwest. But nevertheless, wherever it was, my mother and father worked as a team. Mr. Kelly's program, I see Mr. Kelly in the audience, will tell you what it was like to grow up consciously only of a mother in the trials that she went through. And I think Mr. Kelly knows how much I admire what his mother was. She was a charming woman. He will never know quite the same experience that I had to have a father who shared that load. But that load came to be abandoned, and women were seen often as those who worked to pay the way for the husband to go to further academic work, were the social hosts of other of company management in order that the husband could climb the ladder. They were essentially women who were seen as simply expediting a man's role. And both of them tended to utilize money to take care of the children. That's not the way an earlier generation grew up. But it is the mistake of the period of World War II and thereafter in the man's role that laid the foundation for the reaction that did not take women altogether in a satisfactory direction, which never did capture all American women, which is why the women's movement finally foundered. And tragically, we have the present feminization of poverty as the legacy, as we also have the legacy of divorce and remarriage, because many men did not know how to conduct themselves as husbands. And that was the fact that marriages were breaking up, especially because of World War II and the consequent years that followed. And young men grew up who did not see what fathers should be like. It's one thing when you work with a father and see a father every day at his task. It's another thing, in my case, where our son essentially never saw me at my task. I was in an office. He would see me in the evening or in the morning. But we grew up in a world in which during the summer we saw each other morning, noon, and night, in which we did chores before we went to school, after we came home from school, and on weekends together. We knew what it was like to take care of one another. Not by money, though small monies were always available in Northern California where I grew up during those critical periods, unlike many other areas of the country. But if you want to think back, I think you should realize that this country has drifted back and forth over decades and scores of years, and there are reactions and reactions to those reactions that have led to the present problem, essentially, of broken homes and the consequent lack of example in many cases of both men and women, or why we have not only the single parent family, but the no parent family today, where we have to address the question, in our literature of mothers who are recovering in hospitals or in prison, whose children have no one but some other institution or the state to supervise, whose father may or may not even be known and may never see the child. That's the direction of much of our society. So this weekend, I hope that we will have a broader reflection as to how these things got out of hand. And wouldn't hurt you to see what quality editorials may be presented from time to time in the great newspapers of this country. Additionally, I would like to take a moment of time, since I have not spotted a particular person, I would like to ask, if I may see, where Pita Lee, in this case, from Fiji is. I met him earlier. Are you seated somewhere that I can see your... Thank you. In the middle here, I am very grateful to see again a young man whom I met in Tonga at the Festival of Tabernacles, who impressed me, a Chinese Fijian with the name Lee, the father was obviously Chinese, who asked me once what I thought about his migration to Canada, because Fiji didn't have that many opportunities. I was glad he took my advice and stayed in Fiji, where he also found a wife, a job, and has a responsibility now with the church. He perhaps is earlier than some on the next refreshing program, but I have admired the responsibilities that he has been able to shoulder to assist the leadership of the church there, to be an example of the family, of families for that matter. And both my wife and I are grateful on this particular weekend to remember the fact that they have from time to time sent photographs of their growing family. They have four daughters, none of whom are here on this occasion. I would like to extend our best wishes to the brethren in Fiji, and I know that with the quality and character of the leadership, as I am aware of, that our brethren will do very well there. And it is nice to see someone from that area where I haven't been for now 11 years. It was 1982 that I last visited there when the hurricane struck Tonga. And we went in that part of the world and also to Fiji. The subject today that I presented to church administration was an important topic at the moment, as soon as I knew that I was asked to speak here, and so I wrote it up. The subject is the development of this work, taking a look at the history of the work from essentially 1927 to 1937. In a book, The Autobiography of Herbert W. Armstrong, Volume 1. Most of you have had access to this volume. I happen to have the latest edition. I want to read it because I told a certain person who no longer is with us that this particular volume, not the second one, but in terms of what I have in mind, Volume 1 is probably the most important single document, it is a lengthy one, that Herbert W. Armstrong has left as a legacy to the church, more important than any piece of literature defining doctrine or practice that we regularly send out. More important, certainly, than any book other than this one that he wrote. Here is the story of the practice and the administration and what made it possible from practically nothing to go around the world in 52 years to do in this generation what no other generation since the Roman Empire accomplished in the history of the Church of God. And it was possible because some fundamental decisions were made in how to administer one's life, how to administer group life in the church. The collective responsibility of the ministry, the collective responsibility of the church as a whole. If one understood this, there would have been only one work being done. There would have been no fragments in competition, if that word can even be applied. I want you to see very clearly what it is that happened in those 10 short years, essentially from 1927 to 1937. What I've chosen today is to outline in Volume 1 of the larger format edition. Doesn't matter whether it's hardcover or softcover. This is not the earlier edition, so the page numbers will not be the same. But I will identify in this edition the material. I would ask you to take some notes. I would ask you essentially not to bother with trying to quote what I say, that you should in fact take note of the page number and the paragraphs I read. Then go to this volume or find a copy and then compare it with yours if you do not have one of those two, in which, in this case, Herbert W. Armstrong's picture is on the cover. The earlier ones had his signature on the cover. You will be surprised. Some of you have read it. My wife said it is remarkable what one sometimes fails to remember of what one reads. I will try to be as careful as possible, simply to concentrate on that which is written, and if there is anything that needs a little background to define the time, I'll try to give that. Otherwise, we will listen to the story of how this work began and what it meant in those days to have laid the foundation for a work that has essentially, either in the spoken or written word, has gone round the world, on which foundation the churches of God, the worldwide congregation, is building. For the responsibility today is to see that the congregations are at that stage of mind that it is possible to complete in this generation the responsibility of this generation. So you have situations in which crises inevitably come to see who stays with the vine and to see who does not. I hope you all know how to make the little sign for paragraph. Don't write it out, P-A-R-A-G-R-A-P-H, each time. A paragraph sign in the simplest form for you would simply to be write the capital letter P as in paragraph backward. That's the symbol. Usually there are two lines, but save yourself time and write one. You'll know what it means. I'm going to start on page 353. I'm going to take you through the story of the things you should know in terms of how this work began. Now, in giving information about paragraphing, at the top of a page we usually have continuity. That merely is the top. That's the closing of a paragraph that began at an earlier page. The first paragraph means the first new one on a page. I will start with page 353, paragraph 2. Mr. Armstrong is now telling us in the things that appeared in the Plain Truth in the 1950s and later in the 60s, what it was like to have taken a look at the people among whom he had come when he came to Oregon and had learned about the issue of the Sabbath day. In paragraph 2, it says, that his study with respect to the law of God and the Sabbath day automatically ruled out all churches observing Sunday as those that could possibly represent institutions. I'm adding something here, that would have in fact been doing this part of the work of God. We're not talking about the British and American and Dutch and German Bible societies whose function was to distribute the book. We're talking about those whose responsibility was to do the work that was commissioned to the church. So far as I could learn, it reduced the search to three small groups: the Seventh-day Adventists, the Seventh-day Baptists, and a little almost unheard-of church called the Church of God, which maintained a small publishing house headquarters at Stanbury, Missouri. I visited much later with Mr. Blackwell the headquarters in Stanbury, Missouri. I had never heard of the Church of God, Seventh Day, until I came to college in 1947. It was indeed almost unheard of. I had read many kinds of subjects in the literature of various religious groups, but this one I had never heard of, never seen a publication, never seen a reference to it. That was what puzzled Mr. Armstrong. How to look at what was being done. On page 354, paragraphs 2 and 3, we are dealing here with the year 1927. I looked into the teaching of the Seventh-day Baptists. I found it to be virtually identical, except for observing a different day of the week, with other Protestant denominations, particularly the Baptists. But of these three churches to which the search had been narrowed, only one had the name, the Little Heard of Church of God, with headquarters at Stanbury, Missouri. One would have thought that after 1927, that after 19 centuries from the time Jesus was baptized, one would have expected his church would be widely known, as, if you please, the worldwide Church of God today is. I move to the bottom of page 356 and continue to the top of the next page, 357. It's a new paragraph at the bottom of page 356. Bottom line, I was deeply perplexed. Here was a little church with scattered members, probably numbering less than 2,000, mostly in rural areas. Apparently, as nearly as I could learn, it had a very limited number of local congregations, none as large as 100 members. As I began to come in contact with some of its leaders, they seemed to be men of little education and certainly no college degrees. Its ministry could hardly be described as an educated ministry. Their preaching had a certain fire, yet seemed totally to lack the power that attracts sizable audiences. Next paragraph, or paragraph 1. Could this be God's one and only true church on earth? The very question seemed preposterous. But where else? That is what confronted Mr. Armstrong at the time. He found the story developing as he began to meet with more and more of these people. And so we pick up on page 358, paragraph 3. Therefore, I began to fellowship with their scattered and few members in Oregon, while at the same time refraining from acknowledging membership. Now, Mr. Armstrong had become baptized. I'm skipping over things that are not relevant at this moment. So there was a fellowship with the scattered members in Oregon. But he did not, at the same time, openly acknowledge membership with the headquarters in Stanberry, Missouri. The bottom of page 358. We'll pick up the story here. Much time was spent during those years, as it had been the first 6 months at the public library. I delved, and then he explains that he was reading and studying. He delved into various works and examined the material that the Church of God published. Now we will pick up a little further. At the beginning of the paragraph, ending page 358, in which I read that statement, so he continued to study. The beginning paragraph of that paragraph, the bottom of 358, says, "And so it was in this detached fellowship that Mrs. Armstrong and I continued the first 3.5 years of my ceaseless day and night study of the Bible, of history, and of pertinent allied subjects." So Mr. Armstrong kept his study, and this was, in a sense, a detached fellowship because he had not yet come to understand all of the things that puzzled him about the nature of the church. Page 359, paragraph 2. "Nevertheless, having been a trained magazine and advertising copywriter, the results of the studies that he was making were written up, purely for my own benefit, in article form. My wife began showing these to some women members of the Church of God who lived in Salem, Oregon. They began to urge me to preach before them. But becoming a preacher was the very last thing I had wanted to do. Meanwhile, on their urging," paragraph 3, "a few of these articles had been mailed to the Bible Advocate in Stanberry." This was Missouri. "These articles began appearing on the front page," for style reasons. 359, see, we moved from 358 to 359, and on 359, paragraphs 2 and 3, I have read you this information. "By 1928, A.N. Duggar saw that Mr. Armstrong's style was befitting the Bible Advocate, and so we have the beginning of written material by Herbert W. Armstrong in the publication. Even though the question of how close the fellowship should be was never really discussed at that time, A.N. Duggar, who was the prominent figure in Stanberry, nevertheless appreciated what had been written." Paragraphs 1 and 2, 360. Page 360, paragraph 1 and 2. "No person can receive all truth instantaneously. The human mind receives knowledge gradually." So Mr. Armstrong was coming to learn and unlearn. Paragraph 2. "Now it was a simple truism that if each individual member of the church must be growing in the knowledge of God, constantly overcoming, being corrected, and eliminating error, then all the members together which form the church must also be constantly willing to walk in the new light from God's Word, both as a church and as individuals. Now we don't all walk at the same pace. We don't all walk at the same pace in all subjects. Not every local group moves at the same pace with every other local group." These are my comments. "But nevertheless, it was this perception that Mr. Armstrong describes here as he continued in terms of attending and supporting the published material." Page 362. paragraph 4. Here was the church which appeared to have more truth and less error than any other. It did profess the commandments of God and had the testimony of Jesus Christ. It had the true name of the church that Jesus built. Its members did love what truth they had, and they sacrificed for it. The depression was about to come. In spite of the fact this church didn't appear to be dynamically alive, it was still closer to the biblical characteristics of Christ's true church than any I knew. Page 363 is the story of his first sermon. He puts in parentheses the word sermon. He was asked to speak. And the first sermon is very interesting. Paragraph 2 on this page. I was overcome with an urge to get a certain subject before the brethren, and I was unable to refuse any longer to speak when they had asked him to speak. A meeting was held in a country store building. And he tells the background of the first time he began to speak publicly. This is page 353 under the subject, the first sermon, and paragraphs 2 and 3 and 4. So the story is there. Now, as we move along on page 366, for a little while, paragraph 2, my articles had been appearing on the front page of the Bible Advocate, published by this Church of God in Stanbury, Missouri. He was cooperating with them, attending the local churches. Up until this time, paragraph 3, now 1928, before the Great Depression, there had been no minister of this church in Oregon, except for occasional visits by the minister from Idaho and one from Texas, of whom I had inquired about water baptism during his visit in Oregon in 1927. But there were at that time 50 to 60 members of the church in Oregon from Salem to Eugene. And from the beginning of my speaking before these people, and with my articles being featured in the church paper, no time was lost in sending a minister to Oregon to take charge. He was a young man, about 28 or younger, from Arkansas or Missouri. He came to see me in Portland. His attitude appeared cordial, but very soon after his arrival in Oregon, publication of my articles in the Bible Advocate stopped. Soon I learned the reason. Page 366, this is the bottom paragraph, number 5. I learned the reason. Probably the most influential member in the state at that time was elderly G.A. Hobbs of Oregon City, past 80 years of age. He received a letter from the editor in Stanbury, Missouri, explaining my articles were being discontinued at the request of the young minister newly arrived in Oregon. The grounds were that I was not a member of the church, and it was dangerous to give me this public standing before the brethren. I might gain influence and become their leader and lead them astray. That was the implication. Now, Mr. Hobbs was a former Seventh-day Adventist, and he knew how to communicate, and he knew how to criticize Herbert Armstrong and how to support him. He was simply an open man about his thinking. This aroused the fiery indignation of Mr. Hobbs. He sent a scorching letter back to Stanbury, a copy of which he let me read. It resulted in reinstating my articles for publication. So now we have picked up the story to the top of page 367. I completed the paragraph 5 from the bottom of 366 to top 357. Time moves on, and I will now move to page 409. On page 409, along in November, paragraph 4, the Runcorn family, neighbors of my parents, and it was Mrs. Runcorn who first brought the knowledge of the Sabbath to Loma D. Armstrong, asked me to go with them to a business meeting in November 1930 of the Brethren of the Church of God being held in the home of Mrs. Ira Curtis near Jefferson, Oregon. Although I was a guest, I had never become a member of the church whose headquarters was at Stanbury, Missouri. They insisted that I should act as secretary and take down the meeting minutes. I'm moving from page 409 to 410. I learned that the meeting was called for the purpose of organizing the Oregon members into an Oregon conference. Very important. Page 410. I'm going to read much of the page here. I sensed immediately there was a feeling of division. A.N. Duggar, who was an elder, was the real leader of the church at Stanbury. He was editor of the church's weekly paper sent to members. He was either or had been the president of their general conference from Stanbury, Missouri. I learned they were organized as a general conference with election of officers held biannually. Most of the Oregon members lived in the Willamette Valley in the vicinity of Jefferson. Most of them were in attendance at this meeting. Half were opposed to Elder Duggar. They wanted to organize a state conference. Some of the other states had state conferences. The purpose of this Oregon State Conference was to hold the tithes and church funds contributed by Oregon members in Oregon. But actually, it was of opposition to the dissatisfaction with the Stanbury membership. The other half were verbal in their loyalty and support of Elder Duggar. The dispute led to problems. Tempers flamed. I'm reading further down. Mr. Armstrong arose and with a clear, loud voice asked if he might say a word. Top of page 411, just going on this subject. I was a guest, and they did not refuse. Brethren, I said, you all know how, as recorded in the first chapter of Job, the sons of God came together, and Satan came also. And he discusses how they had begun to lose their temper in this discussion. He asked them to pray. Without another word, Mr. Armstrong dropped to his knees and began asking God to rebuke the devil, this controversial spirit that was rousing these men to anger. When I arose, there were some wet eyes, but no angry voices anymore. These people were sincere. They simply believed what they believed and had allowed themselves to be caught off guard and roused to anger. Now, that's the background of a very interesting point that I draw to your attention. The founding of the Oregon Conference, that is, the organization of the Brethren affiliated with the Church of God Seventh Day in Stanbury, Missouri, into an administrative government in Oregon for the supervision and distribution of the tithes and the work that the Brethren could do thereby. I will go to page 412. Mr. Armstrong, in paragraph 1, speaks of his ordination in Oregon in 1931. I believe that elderly G.A. Hobbs, first paragraph, page 412, of Oregon City, previously mentioned, was made the first president of this state conference, and that O.J. Runcorn, with whom I had come to this meeting, was president the second year. I have in my files my ministerial license certificate, which was reproduced in this autobiography, dated March 3, 1932, and signed by O.J. Runcorn as president. Now, this moves ahead of the story, but Mr. Armstrong told it in this sequence. It was about a year after I was ordained, probably my second certificate. He never found an earlier one. We searched, you know, when the autobiography was being published. And it appears this may have been the second one. I don't believe the first one was ever found. No further comment, because I never heard of it. At the close of this business meeting, the newly elected officers caused me great embarrassment. They asked me if I would hold an evangelistic campaign with them in the church building they rented in Harrisburg. So Mr. Armstrong got ahead of the story. We were back there in November 1930, and he mentions this here. I only bring it out of context because it is in the sequence. But the Oregon Conference was the conference within the Churches of God that ordained Mr. Armstrong, and in so doing, two things happened. One, he, in accepting ordination in 1931, most certainly recognized his membership in the Oregon Conference, and secondarily, the Oregon Conference must have recognized his membership. On page 412, he tells the story that he asked the brethren to pray for him if indeed he was going to speak on their behalf in a public evangelistic campaign. 412, paragraphs 2 and 3 is the story of the beginning here of his being drawn into a work of responsibility, which did not begin until 1931, after the Oregon Conference was formed, after he had earlier, for some 3 years and more, contributed to the Bible Advocate. Page 414, paragraphs 1 to 5. It was their turn to be embarrassed. Perhaps some had been spending an hour a day in prayer. I was sure most of them had not. Their tempers would not have boiled over into a near fistfight if they had. But as I had been too embarrassed to refuse, they were too embarrassed to refuse to pray. To refuse to devote an hour a day on their knees would be very unchristian. Yet that would have been more embarrassing than to go through with it. So they all pledged. These brethren realized that the Stanbury Church was not getting the gospel to the world with power. In this area, the church was virtually impotent. The Oregon brethren were anxious to get the work going. Although I had been greatly humbled by business reverses, the members were aware of my past experience in the business world. And from the time of this business meeting, the brethren in Oregon, November 1930, looked to me for leadership to revitalize the work that the members in Oregon came to be interested in. There had been no minister in the church resident in Oregon. And it is interesting, you see, that in fact it was where the brethren were without a resident minister that they came to be enlivened by growing understanding and saw a reason to organize these brethren into doing a work as other state conferences had been organized. And they were interested in having Mr. Armstrong's business acumen contribute to beginning of a campaign. The first public preaching then occurred. We are dealing now with the year 1931. The ordination, of course, was introduced premature to show who was in the Oregon Conference. The name of Hobbs and Runcorn were just pointed out there. Now, the question of baptizing people who came to be converted as a result of the evangelistic campaign is discussed on page 416. The subject of water baptism had been the very first I had studied. A young minister of the Church of God who had been sent out from Stanbury, Missouri, had been in an automobile accident in Harrisburg. I am here essentially reading all that's beneath the last section called Who Should Baptize. He was confined to bed with a broken leg at the time, and I consulted him. It was a problem neither of us had been confronted with before. Out here in Oregon, where there had been no resident minister, who should do the baptizing? And it was agreed that the person who was responsible for speaking, as Philip, a deacon, was used of God, should be at least responsible for baptizing. So he baptized them. This brought stern criticism from authorities higher up in the church. There were criticisms because the conference paid expenses when I was not considered a member of the Church of God Seventh Day General Conference centered in Stanbury, Missouri. And at this point, you remember, he was asked to speak before he was an ordained minister. He baptized the first converts before he was ordained in 1931, because I have gone back to the time of the meeting that was held in 1930, November, in which the Oregon Conference was organized, and then they asked him to speak publicly before his ordination, and then there were some people who were baptized. The work of the Oregon Conference was beginning, and it was done through a man who had not yet been baptized, which baptism did not occur until June of 1931. Just want you to know the background. Page 426, paragraph 3. Some of my comments might surprise you because you can read through and not necessarily understand the time sequence. Ordained Christ Minister is a subhead. I had come to see at a certain meeting a number of things that Mr. Armstrong then describes. I won't go through all of the details, but Mr. Armstrong was earning a living by himself. That's the important thing. 1931, he was earning a living. 426, paragraph 3. Tells us about his job. The bottom of 426 on to 427 said, it was decided by the officers of the Oregon Conference on the next all-day meeting that I would be ordained. This was June 1931. Paragraph 2, page 426, tells you about that ordination in June 1931. After he had in fact been preaching a great deal of time for 3.5 years. So Mr. Armstrong was asked to write since 28 and to begin to speak shortly after that. And he was both writing and speaking from 1928 to the middle of 1931. And the officers of the Oregon Conference on that all-day meeting decided that he should be ordained. Now, that ordination I've already alluded to in 1931 because he put earlier the names of the people who were president of this conference who had signed the second certificate. That's why that happens to be early in the sequence. I mentioned that because that's 1932. That was plugged in there in order to show who was in charge of the Oregon Conference. So they clearly then accepted his membership as a converted person contributing to the church, and in accepting ordination, he accepted the reality that he had membership in the Oregon Conference, and in fact, he had been assigned to a responsibility to carry out the work of the Oregon Conference. I shall never forget that moment of my ordination. That's the top of 427. That's the first paragraph. One sentence, as one may well understand. In moving along, I go to paragraph 7. Let it be made plain here. 427, paragraph 7. I was ordained by and under the authority of the Oregon Conference of the Church of God, separately incorporated, not by the Stanbury, Missouri headquarters. And of course, that you should bear in mind, because this was where the membership of the church came to be interested more and more in, shall we call it, evangelizing the area in which they lived. These people, by the way, were recent comers to Oregon. Many of these had come from the Midwest, Oklahoma, and Missouri. In fact, I don't remember that I could identify how many of these people had lived that long in Oregon, because when I met them many years later, most of them had in fact come at the time. Many later had come too, but many of these people had come in comparatively recent times. The Great Dust Bowl had yet to occur, or was already beginning by 1931. So Mr. Armstrong was under the authority of the Oregon Conference of the Church of God, separately incorporated. It was affiliated with the General Conference centered in Stanbury, Missouri, which was the headquarters of the church as a whole. That's a very important section there, page 427, paragraph 7. I move along to page 437, paragraph 3. It was planned that I was to leave Eugene and put a campaign up at St. Helens, Oregon, with a minister by the name of Roy Daly, who had just returned from Stanbury and other points in the Midwest. The conference had just employed him. Now there were three of us on the payroll at $20 per week. At this rate, the conference treasury was soon going to be empty. This was the time, if you please, when $20 went a long way. Think about how far it would go today. Roy Daly, Herbert W. Armstrong, Elder Taylor were three individuals who were employed by the Oregon Conference. That's defined on page 437, paragraph 3. The end of the chapter, of course, is that page. So we now know that Mr. Armstrong was on salary from the Oregon Conference. That's where the tithes were sent. The conference, in addition, sent a certain sum to headquarters in Stanbury, Missouri. On page, we'll move along here, 443 to 444. These three men worked together. About 2 weeks after a number of meetings were being held at a place called Umapine, a letter from Mrs. Florence Curtis, Secretary of the State Conference of Oregon, informed us that the business meeting of the board had been called for only 2 or 3 days after our receipt of the letter. So the three men essentially came to separate from one another in terms of the way they went, for the simple reason that it was quite apparent that the General Conference Board could no longer afford to maintain three salaries. Elder Taylor was retained, the others were not. So Herbert Armstrong was no longer on salary. 444, I will read the 8th paragraph. As it turned out, the special business meeting was called off. Mr. Daly had raced back to the valley, that's the Willamette Valley, But just as he had anticipated, even though the board meeting was called off, he and I were laid off and Elder Taylor was kept on. Roy Daly hoped he could keep all three, or at least himself, on. But Mr. Armstrong completed the campaign. We will now move. We're not dealing with the details of how the work grew so much as to see the administrative background. I will move now to page 470. The top of the page. It was not until February 1933 that my prayers to be relieved of a newspaper responsibility occurred, that were fulfilled, and he was allowed to return to God's ministry. He finished after he was terminated from employment, not because he wasn't a minister. He was terminated from financial employment, but finished the campaign, and then he had to look for a living, and it was with the newspaper. So by February 1933, the Oregon Conference had accumulated sufficient money. So essentially, you had upwards of a year plus, part of 1931, the rest of 1932, in which he was unemployed by the church. The Depression had begun with October 1929, and these people, of course, were feeling it, as the country as a whole was. So Mr. Armstrong was re-employed. That's page 470, the top of the page. 482. Paragraph 1. One day late in February 1933, a farmer, Mike Helms, drove his pickup truck to our house. He had come to take us back to the valley. The church conference had now accumulated a small balance. This is all a part of 482. That's the page number in paragraph 1. The church conference had now accumulated a small balance. Mike Helms was president of the conference. He said he would be able to pay us $3 a week only. You remember, it started out at 20. Now, in the Depression, and by the way, money was getting more and more valuable. As the Depression went on, money was more and more valuable. Not like some people who think that when the salary drops, money is less valuable. This $3 accomplished more than $3 would have, let's say, in 1931. Most people don't realize in a Depression, money is more and more valuable. In inflation, money is less and less valuable. You thought you were getting rich when things were inflating. Well, if you had money in the Depression, you were getting richer. That is, if you had money. He said they would be able to pay us only $3 per week. The farmer brethren would supply us with vegetables, and members would buy other food for us, including beans. Somehow Mr. Armstrong never found beans his favorite vegetable. This is the re-employment of February 1933. They got back, in other words, into the work of the Oregon Conference. Now I will go to page 517. The story of the beginning of that Oregon Conference, the beginning of his publishing work and speaking work and ordination are past, entering into the ministry as an employed minister, as distinct from being a minister and unemployed by the church, but employed by a business, is now the background that I'll take you through in 517. Paragraph 1. The very second time in my life I ever preached, if those early efforts could be called that, an opposing minister had appeared and devoted most of his sermon in an effort to tear down what I had preached in the first sermon. Another minister had tried to prevent my articles from appearing further in the Bible Advocate, the Oregon publishing organ of the Church of God. A plot had been hatched by two ministers during the Salem, Oregon meetings to discredit me and get me off the payroll of the Oregon Conference. So no sooner had he been on that now a new problem would arise in 1933. I will move to page 518. The opposition through the spring and summer of 1933, this is under the heading, the Pork Obsession, Pork, P-O-R-K, had come through two ministers who had moved up to Oregon from California, whose names I will not give. The argument was this: did every single person who was baptized have to know about and give up certain things before they could be... Sorry, that was incorrectly stated. That was what Mr. Armstrong, how he looked at it. The churches of God as a whole had operated under the premise that members should have learned certain things before they were baptized, one of which was that you should have learned all about unclean meats and understood that and obeyed, as if unclean meats could never be a temptation, before you could be baptized. Mr. Armstrong perceived that, in fact, they should avoid unclean meats, but that many people should learn about that later if they didn't already know, but that baptism shouldn't be delayed until they had learned all these things. And that became a controversy which was finally settled. But you sense a problem. Now, what is important here is that Mr. Armstrong cooperated with the Oregon Conference, even when there were debates concerning how to administer baptism, whether before or after you learned about unclean meats. They came to an agreement that the end result was essentially the same, and therefore there was no fundamental difference in the ultimate result in the brethren. Mr. Armstrong did not assume that because there was a difference in administration, he'd have to resign and start a competitive work, once you get the point. He recognized that it was possible to lay the cards on the table, and it was possible for the other ministers from headquarters, or that now had come from California and were at least representing the Oregon Conference, to discuss the matter. And they agreed that the end result was essentially the same, and so they could cooperate. Page 420 tells the story of further problems. I want to read the bottom of 420. I had not mentioned it before, but in April 1933, during the Salem meeting, I had started the issuing of a monthly bulletin for members of the conference. It was mimeographed. I had hired the bulletin printed at the local mimeograph shop, page 521, bottom of 520, top of 521. And so Mr. Armstrong here introduces for the Oregon Conference a bulletin. He was capable of publishing material. Others may not have seen the value of some kind of publication each month to tell of the work of the Oregon Conference of the Church of God Seventh Day. At the Fisher home where he was staying after starting the Fir Butte school meetings, I had borrowed a typewriter. The Eugene mimeograph dealer permitted me to use one of his mimeographs without charge, that I had to pay for the stencils, goes without saying, in the paper. These costs were paid by the Oregon Conference Treasury. So we have here the fact that there was a bulletin being published. There was no plain truth yet, you know. Now we move along to 524. Under the title, The Double Cross. 524. As soon as I had finished, Mr. Fisher's car was to arrive to take me back to the Fir Butte schoolhouse for the evening meeting. I was forced to leave immediately. under the circumstances, in a meeting in which he was attending, I had asked board members and ministers if they would postpone any action. I'm not going in the background of this. He happens to have been at a meeting. Half of the brethren present were very much on my side. As I left the church, this half rose and walked out to assure me of their sympathy, that they would resist any action against me. So there was this constant problem. Mr. Armstrong did not decide to leave merely because he felt he was under opposition within the conference, sometimes from people from the outside. I want you to know that picture. As soon as I and all who would support me had gone outside, Messrs. Ray and Oberg broke their word. That is, they had agreed to take no action at that time, since the members were going out to greet Mr. Armstrong goodbye. They immediately offered a resolution that I be required, if I remain in the conference, to baptize people in the way that they insisted with regard to pork, and it also even involved the question of smoking. And those remaining inside the church were swayed into voting for it. As soon as I heard of the action that they were going to require me, Mr. Armstrong is speaking and writing here, to teach people certain things that they must know before they have the power of the Holy Spirit always to resist temptation, he said, I immediately wrote a letter canceling the $3 per week salary, suggesting they give it to Messrs. Oberg and Ray. I did not resign from the conference, but I refused further salary. Page 524. That's at the bottom of the page. I have simply been reading all the way through, beginning with the subhead, the double cross. 525. As for me and my house, I then said firmly, we shall serve the Eternal our God, and Him only shall we serve. If men pay us a salary, even as small as $3 per week, we have now learned we must preach only what men order us to preach. Now remember, the conference essentially was divided in half. There were those who saw it one way and those who saw it another. And it was an attempt on the part of one to force their will on the part of the other half. The conference did not break up the relationship between the two factions, shall we call it, in the Oregon Conference was not terminated. But Mr. Armstrong's salary was terminated by himself. It may seem like a small step to require great courage to give up a $3 a week income. But it really didn't require much courage. They had learned already the significance of faith. And in those days, probably as much was coming in the form of non-money as was coming in the form of money. This was the crossroads, a final pivotal crucial test before the living Christ began opening the doors of mass communication through which God's work would come to life after centuries of sleeping and go on to all the world, which he didn't dream of then, preparing the way for Christ's return to earth as ruler over all nations, a perspective that he didn't dream of to start with, and not for perhaps another decade. Anyway, this is the story in which the Oregon Conference was made up of ministers on salary and ministers not on, a minister not on salary, and brethren who were encouraging that a work be done more and more, and others who were in opposition to a work. And the interesting thing, this kind of opposition was moving along now for 3 years. 1931, 1932, 1933. So much for that background. page 526, paragraphs 2 and 3. 526. Mrs. Armstrong and I continued to fellowship with the brethren. I continued to work with them and with their ministers as far as that was possible. The lay brethren looked to me for the leadership of getting the work going. But from that all-day wrangle, I was independent of them and their ministers financially. From that time, I was dependent solely on God. We did not ask or solicit financial contributions from any except those who had voluntarily become financial co-workers with us and who had been and this has been the policy ever since, which is irrelevant to our story here. He did not send letters out to all the church trying to persuade them. He simply had those who were already supporting the work of the Oregon Conference that God had been developing through him and through others at the same time, but usually the fruit was born when he was alone, and it was much more difficult to see what was happening in any positive results when he was working with the others. Now, I will move along from page 526, paragraphs 2 and 3. Paragraph 3 I won't read, but it tells you here of the gradual growth of the work over time. But we will now move to 529, paragraph 5. In October 1, 1933, the bulletin carried the report that more than 20 signified their desire to establish a new Sabbath-keeping church in the area where a family had been living, the Fishers. So the bulletin was continuing to be published that Mr. Armstrong had encouraged, just so you have the background there, 533, that's the page number, a surprising response, 533 to the end of 534, is the story of getting on radio by invitation. I will not read the details, but I want you at least to know the background. That Mr. Armstrong got on radio by invitation, and he was among other speakers. He got on there primarily because there were people who weren't showing up. Of other, let's say, groups of people or denominations. On October 21st, this is page 533, paragraph 7. At the home of Mr. and Mrs. Ed Smith, the man who couldn't afford to tithe, if you remember that article, just across the road from the Jeans School, which has been moved since, and I saw it last year, it's cut in two, and it's a private residence, 4 miles west of Fairbute, a new Church of God was organized with Mr. Fisher as deacon and myself as pastor. Meetings continued 3 times a week. These new members and lay brethren of the Oregon Conference all approved it joyfully as an effective evangelistic activity of the church. In other words, the brethren, half of the Oregon Conference that was alive and had been asleep, now had awakened to a responsibility of the church. Those who were awakened to what was going on, who had essentially lost contact, tended to be in opposition. And those who had insight into what God was beginning to do through the Oregon Conference supported a continued work and the plan for a radio broadcast. So I sent out a letter to the small mailing list. When Mr. Armstrong saw what radio could do, then they were planning for just such an opportunity. The cost of a radio broadcast would be $2.50 each time. That might seem strange today. It's incomprehensible what has happened to our money. Anyway, that was to begin in the beginning, January 1934. Now, page 555. As you can tell, we're nearing the conclusion. There are only so many pages, 646. 555. The bottom of this page, paragraph 4. During these late winter and spring months of 1934, the opposition of Elders Ray and Oberg did not cease. That's the other half of the Oregon Conference. I had rejected receiving the further $3 weekly salary from the Oregon Conference after the all-day wrangle in early August 1933. But this did not appease them. At a biennial general conference meeting of the church at Stanbury, Missouri, which probably was held in August, he does not remember, A.N. Duggar had lost his control, and the Church of God Seventh Day, centered at Stanbury, Missouri, split over the question of government. And Mr. Duggar essentially went to Salem, West Virginia, and that was the Salem branch, and the other branch of the General Conference stayed centered in Stanbury, Missouri. So I want you to note that the lively branch of the church was the Oregon Conference branch, and the headquarters itself had split by August of 1933. I will not go into those details, but in any case, A.N. Duggar accepted Mr. Armstrong as one of the ministers. There were to be 70 of them. He thought numbers were important. There were to be 7 deacons, 12 apostles, notice the order, and there were 70 others. Noting that I'll skip that. Anyway, on page 557, Mr. Duggar devised a board of 7 to handle the business of the church, making himself chairman. He knew that whoever controlled the purse strings controlled the church, whether he was a deacon and the others were apostles or not. Mr. Duggar's board of 7 handled all church income and finances for the eastern half, centered in Salem, West Virginia. But eastern half is the wrong way to put it, because it was the eastern half of the country, but he had people in support of him from Oregon to West Virginia. And the others were also scattered across the country. It carried all the real power to govern. Mr. Duggar had control over the salary of the 12. The word business appeared in the King James Version, but in fact, it isn't just a question of money, it was duty, as Mr. Armstrong, quoting the RSV and Moffat, has. There are many other duties a deacon has than merely handling the finances. So we had a situation here where, indeed, there were 2 factions now in the Oregon Conference. One loyal to Stanbury, which had incorporated as the Oregon Conference. I'm misreading that. One of them still loyal to Stanbury, as it was called. The other, which had incorporated as the Oregon Conference, being somewhat enamored of the new organization. That is, it would appear that a significant group of the Oregon Conference was also interested in Mr. Duggar's work in Salem. Mr. Duggar claimed world headquarters as Jerusalem, Palestine, United States headquarters in Salem, West Virginia. Mr. Armstrong made comments about it. He cooperated primarily with Mr. Duggar because Mr. Duggar was the one who had initially allowed Mr. Armstrong's material to be published in the Bible Advocate. And Mr. Armstrong was not about to take sides between the two groups. Mr. Duggar was always the more favorable to Mr. Armstrong, just perhaps out of his own educational background and experience. Messrs. Oberg and Ray, page 558, paragraph 2. made every effort to urge the Oregon Conference to go with Salem. One of the basic doctrinal points of the Salem organization was abstaining from pork and observing rigidly the laws of clean and unclean, to the point, you see, that you had to know all this before you were baptized. They are considered even today, and I visited Salem, West Virginia also, the more strict of the two. Mr. Fisher and Mr. Ellis and other members at Jean's and I decided we would simply leave the answer in God's hands as to what should happen with respect to the Oregon Conference. If the Salem reorganization accepted me as one of the 70, in spite of opposition of Oberg and Ray, we would go with it. We would go in. Otherwise, we would remain independent. That is, Mr. Armstrong was willing to say that if they accepted him, even if there was opposition in the conference, he would be willing to continue to work. And indeed, they did accept, and Mr. Armstrong did regularly work with them. 34, 35, 36. 19, this is the depth of the depression. Page 561, the center. This is under the new heading, Cooperating, Not Joining. We of the Church of God, meeting at the Jean Schoolhouse, along with the brethren of the Oregon Conference, decided to go along with it in cooperation. But we of the new local church near Eugene did not join in the sense of becoming an integral part. That is, those congregations that Mr. Armstrong specifically raised up remained essentially in cooperation, whereas those of the Oregon Conference, including people who were supporting Mr. Armstrong, essentially went in as participants of the new organization representing the Oregon Conference, of course, and working especially with Salem, West Virginia. Later on, they got together again, then they separated. That's unimportant to us. I began to send in regular ministers' reports. Next paragraph, page 561. This paragraph 6. But I did not accept salary or expense money from them. None in our local church put himself under their authority. We kept ourselves free to obey God as set forth in the Scriptures should any differences come up. And they did later come up. So what you had was people within the Oregon Conference wholly cooperative with one or the two groups, Salem or Stanberry, and those groups that Mr. Armstrong had raised up working side by side. They were beginning to expand the work of the broadcast and then of the magazine, which started in February 1934. It was, in fact, a church that was never fully organized. But since he was considered one of the 70, Mr. Armstrong did send in regular ministerial reports. 561, the center of the page. Now, I will move to page 632. On Sunday, May 2, 1937, the program of the three network stations was dedicated to high school students. By arrangements with the principal, the combined boys and girls glee clubs of that church furnished the musical portion of the program. The message was directed to high school students in their own language, titled Getting a Real Kick Out of Life. 632, this is paragraph 2. A special note was sent on the Monday preceding to principals of the High School of Oregon and Southwestern Washington, asking them to announce the program to students in assembly. About first week of July, another 6 weeks campaign was started in Eugene. The attendance was good. As usual, there were a number of converts. So Mr. Armstrong was beginning to move along, I'm dealing with 1937, in bringing the work of the church to the attention of the public, in the schools, on the radio, in print. Now, there was a particular camp meeting. It was the last of our cooperation with Salem, West Virginia. The son of one of the so-called 12 apostles had informed me of a plot hatched at a meeting he attended with his father, in which the so-called leading ministers of the Salem group intended to use a camp meeting of which we at Eugene, Oregon were hosts to attempt to discredit and ruin the radio broadcast, which was the work of both the Oregon Conference and the other congregations Mr. Armstrong had raised up, over which he, in fact, was their specific pastor. He never assumed responsibility over the others unless the conference approved it, even though the brethren raised up by him or by others tended to meet together, as they did. You know, I even spoke to the congregation on Scravel Hill at Jefferson, Oregon, as late as the early 1950s, when cooperation continued. Bottom of page 632. I had announced the camp meeting over the air weeks ahead and invited all listeners to attend. Now, what happened was this. They intended to discredit the radio broadcast and the work at the meeting in which the Eugene Church of God was host. The time had come when they agreed that they would not try to do this. Because Mr. Armstrong said, if you try this, I won't hold a camp meeting. And he was the one who made the decision as to whether there would be a camp meeting or not. So they agreed not to speak against the program. But there was still an undercurrent of bitterness. At a minister's meeting, this very apostle who had always appeared friendly to me moved himself willingly to give a Judas kiss. Now, in a meeting at this camp meeting where they said they would not do this, 1937, this minister, unnamed here, having the floor in pretended sympathy that dear Brother Armstrong had worked so hard and was so overworked that they decided to help me by relieving me of some of my burdens. Therefore, they had decided to appoint another of their ministers, one totally hostile to me, as the pastor of the church at Jefferson. One elder and one deacon of the Jefferson church and Mr. Armstrong raised up many of the members who were attending there. It was an older church, as well as the combined churches at Alvador, Jeans, and Eugene that met at Eugene. One elder and a deacon shocked that the Jefferson church, you see, was now to be put in the hands of another who was an enemy of the work at a camp meeting held by the Eugene Church of God. They were, in a sense, seditious in an attempt to destroy the work of the Eugene church, under the subterfuge that Mr. Armstrong was overworked. They were shocked and thoroughly aroused at this so evident subterfuge and bit of deceitful hypocrisy as a plot to take over that church and thus rob the broadcast of its tithes and offerings, so much so that they resigned immediately from their responsibilities to the Oregon Conference. All of us at Eugene Church and half of the members at Jefferson severed all connection and effort to cooperate with those who had proved themselves willing to enter into the meeting of the Church of God and to try to destroy it by taking away the Radio Church of God, as it was called, the financial support at Jefferson. The church here had no more choice. Up to this time, after years, 1937, there had been this kind of cooperation. We are here at a critical point in time where, from within the Oregon Conference, people took advantage of the work that was being done in a camp meeting being held and had themselves said they would not raise a question with respect to broadcast publishing or anything, and their intent was, in fact, to split the support of the work. Now, notice what was happening, that they themselves realize now that the time had come, that you cannot continue to do it for themselves, and their intent, and they did succeed in taking away the Eugene Church, and Mr. Armstrong simply recognized that that was their responsibility. That's wrong, Eugene, I mean Jefferson Church. They took away that ministerial responsibility. Now, the brethren who were attending Jefferson did not leave that congregation, but were attending as late as the 1950s when I came there to Eugene. We were working in the summer, earning money. That's between my junior and senior year. The brethren did not withdraw, but the leadership decided that they could no longer function as part of the Oregon Conference. So the Eugene Church of God and the members scattered, meeting with other members of the Oregon Conference, continued to support the work of the Eugene Church and to meet with the brethren at Jefferson. And I was even asked to speak to them. My first topic, this is not in the autobiography, was the subject of evolution. I explained to them one Sabbath what evolution had done to the thinking of young people. That was the first sermon. The second sermon was given by Elder, and his name I remember but will not say here. His topic was people with heads the size of wash buckets. He came from Arkansas and thought in those terms. Now, when I heard his sermon, I thought he was also talking about those who were believing the doctrine of evolution. And I thought it was remarkable how he understood the minds of those who had been entrapped with this and thought they were important. After services, Elder, or Mr. Henyon, some of you remember his name, he took me aside and he said, "Do you know what the subject was about?" I thought it did. He said it was about you. In other words, you could not speak among those people, but what the ministers representing that organization were out to attack. So I at least had the experience to know their state of mind. But not uncommonly, we went there even when I didn't speak. We met in the morning, let's say in Eugene. We could meet in the afternoon at Jefferson. Sometimes I would attend at a later year services in Portland, Oregon. I have attended their own congregation of the Church of God Seventh Day in Eugene. But this, I think, is very important at this juncture, 1993, that you carefully look at the record of cooperation. You carefully look at the fact that the organization of the Churches of God were quite different than today. And in fact, over a period from 1928 to 37, roughly 9 years' time, despite problems, both brethren and the leadership and Mr. Armstrong and his wife, all of them attempted to cooperate, and the last thing they wanted to do was to terminate that relationship. The termination of that relationship formally occurred at Jefferson, Oregon. But in fact, Mr. Armstrong still communicated from time to time with A.N. Duggar when those ministers asked Mr. Armstrong's assistance into World War II and afterward. He would speak for them. When Mr. A.N. Duggar came to Southern California, when Mr. Gene Michael was a student at that time, I remember because he was there, it was amazing. We went to listen to him. Mr. Armstrong said, "I would like you brethren in Pasadena to hear Mr. A.N. Duggar," the 1950s. And when we got there, he never had seen such a crowd before. And he immediately ducked behind the building because he didn't know what he was running into. And then I saw him peep around the corner. He had never seen so many people. And I would say we filled the building. And we got out the song books, you know, and a few things had been changed. And they were singing a song. And we all sang the words that we use. That was quite an experience. And suddenly the song leader looked up and noticed that everybody was singing something that was not in the song book. A word here, a word there. I looked into, it's not hard to see, you know, women's purses are often a little larger than men's. Many of the women whom I'd never seen had purses, and inside the purses were copies. Each one had usually one copy of The Plain Truth. So they were getting our literature, and here we were listening to Mr. A.N. Duggar speak on a topic. This is the interesting story of how a work over a period of time where participation beginning in 1927-28 and continuing for decades thereafter, but only informally after 1937, has enabled a lively branch of the Church of God to go around the world and to be recognized. Whereas when Mr. Armstrong heard about them in 1927, they were essentially unknown. Today, it's quite different. The worldwide Church of God is widely known at all levels of government, so much so that people have books about us, both at Salem and new headquarters. Stanberry is no longer, that's in Denver. I went there at Salem and I saw what they were doing and I liked a lot of the things they're publishing. That's not a problem. They have a great deal of truth yet. I said, look, they were showing me their equipment. This is just a few years ago, early 1980s. I went there to visit the oldest Church of God in this country that had ceased to be separately meeting. But I wanted to see the building in which they met at Wilbur, West Virginia. And I met the owner who received it back. Her family had given it to the work of the church in the 1850s. I happened to be the recipient of a kind gift from her. She gave me the closing logbook of the Church of God, the oldest church that was assembling, and I'm in the possession of it. That was for the period of time of 1947 to around 1952. She said, nobody else is interested. I have photographs of people who were attending long before I was born. But I talked to this man in charge, and I said, look, there's no reason your message couldn't be far more widely known. And I explained to him the techniques we use. They said, we don't do that. We just pass it by word of mouth. No advertising, no radio, no television. I will add this. That's of the devil. That's what he was his thinking. And I could see what Jesus said to a certain church in Revelation. It said, I have opened a door and no man can shut. And I have shut a door and no man can open. And in this country, the door was open to the Eugene congregation. And it has been, for practical purposes, shut ever since the middle 1930s to any, in this case, either of the two primary branches of the Church of God Seventh Day. But it was the people who were lively in the Oregon Conference that gave rise to this work that has spread all over the world in those 52 years. In 1985, Mr. Tkach was given responsibility. This work has now been moving to 1993, and we are in a period of financial stress, nothing like the depth of the 1930s, but it is important that I remind you that a church was born at the time of such stress. And perhaps the greatest spiritual state of this church yet to come is best seen as a result of the stresses that are on God's people and on us economically today. Mr. Tkach has been trained as a person who works with others, a team man, and as a person who understands that his primary responsibility, not to neglect of any other, but his primary responsibility is to see to the spiritual state of the church and its financial state. And we are here continuing to do a work that had grown worldwide, and we are still building, shall we say, the superstructure on the extensive foundation that was built in those first 52 years, beginning with 1934 and ending with the life of Mr. Armstrong in January in 1986. I hope all of you will see a copy of the autobiography on your shelves or find one somewhere from a friend and read this and get the feel of the spirit of cooperation and the problems and the patience and the understanding at a time when the Church of God had yet to understand how the government of God would operate. They were casting about, not understanding a topic. That is why they were falling apart and why it was that one lively branch of the Oregon Conference that was awake laid the foundation of the work of which we are participants and heirs today.